Welcome to Making Inclusion Happen, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre for Inclusive Education here at the Queensland University of Technology. Season 2 of Making Inclusion Happen focused specifically on the work of higher degree research students, sometimes referred to as HDRs. We will hear about the projects, past and present, that have been conducted under the supervision of C4IE academics and how HDR students' research has impacted their thinking, decision making, and practice.
On Tuesday, the 29th of November, four higher degree research students from the Centre for Inclusive Education presented a symposium at the Australian Association for Research in Education, or AARE, conference. And the symposium was titled Propelling Higher Degree Inclusive Education Research During Disrupted Times. I'm lucky enough today to have this group of high-achieving HDR scholars with me. So welcome to today's episode, Lara Meyer Pike, Elise Bray, Julie Arnold, and me as well. Each of us are HDR members from C4IE's Higher Degree Support Network, or the HDR Support Network, which we established in 2020 as a C4IE research training initiative. So you can, you know, you'll remember the beginning of 2020 was as COVID struck. And so the HDR Network really aimed, you know, in the instance of COVID or not, to provide a space for HDRs to come together and really foster a culture of HDR research excellence and bring us together as a peer group, but also connecting with academic members. So the network's been going since 2020 in around February, and we've got 87 members at the moment. And you can read more about the HDR network on the C4IE website, and I'll pop some information there and links in the show notes. But basically, the HDR network exists for members to be able to engage in online meetings. We discuss topics that are of interest to us. We go along to some of the existing C4IE initiatives like the research masterclasses and forums. But we also have some nice bespoke events that are just for our HDR network members, like HDR The Voice, which is a great chance for us to practice for the 3-minute thesis competition. So thanks so much, Elise and Lara and Julie, for joining me today. I was really keen to connect with you all to talk a little bit about our symposium, but also, you know, the crux of that symposium was thinking about how having the network has helped us to really propel our research through what has been a really disruptive couple of years. So I'd love to hear from you about how the network has helped you to keep on that research journey, but also to really push yourselves to new heights with the quality of research that you're producing, you know, this morning before we got on our talk. Thanks, Julie. Yeah, jump on in.
So I thought before we start talking about matters of quality, and I think there's a lot to talk about there, I think quantity is where I'd like to start, you know, propelling higher degree research. I think that the term propel is a good one. You know, you need more than anything to establish momentum and keep it going. And so the idea of having a group like this, I think the beauty of having a group like this is that you get the momentum of people, don't you? You gather, you know, you're surrounding yourself with people who help you keep moving the work forward. And I was thinking about how that kind of works. You know, I see this particular group doesn't have a common purpose in that we're all doing the same project or what have you, but our purpose is related. So we have a feeling of common purpose. So there's the idea of kind of gentle or intelligent accountability to each other, I think. You know, I don't know in what way I would be letting anyone down in this group if I fell over at a milestone or what have you. But there is that sense that we are accountable to each other for just keeping going.
I totally agree, Julie. I think it's the accountability for having people you can share your milestones and your success with, right? Like once you say out loud, I'm going to submit by the end of November 2023.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm going to write for 20 minutes every day or 2 hours every day or at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree.
I agree. Thanks for having us, Hayley. I think for me in particular, being part of this group, probably the first thing was building my confidence. When you English is not your first language, I think I was very, very unsure and, you know, going through the imposter syndrome. And then you come across a group and you realize that everybody goes through the same things and just different sort of concerns. And it's great to be able to share your experiences. You know, you might have a great relationship with your supervisors, but it is different when you have peers because you're learning at the same time, and I think you're sharing opportunities and building each other's resilience as well. And particularly when the network started in 2020, I went on leave because I couldn't collect data for my research. So being part of the group was really important to keep me connected to the project that I wanted to do and not let that sort of, you know, slowly die and around everything that was happening in the world. So it was great to have that little group to, and we hope, you know, we love having new people as well that comes along and we want to learn what other people are studying. And we try to make that connection about, you know, the work that someone else is doing and how that might relate to your work or even learn about something that you had no idea about. So, yeah.
How about you, Elise?
Hi, Hayley, Lara, Julie, it's lovely to be with you. I think, and I confess that I was a little bit nervous about joining the HDR support network when it started because I was beginning my journey and I felt like I really didn't know much. And it was not, I wasn't made to feel unwelcome when I started. And I know that the three of you are further on in your journey than I am, but that was actually part of the value of it for me, that I was able to learn from you and listening to the different struggles or the things that you were going through made me still feel part of that group. So I'd say to anybody that wants to be a part of that, it doesn't matter what stage of the HDR you're up to, there's somebody in the group who can support you and teach you and share their wisdom and their experience with you, which is highly beneficial. Because, Hayley, you mentioned that not only do we have that support network with each other, but we also have that support from academics within the faculties, which is fantastic. And through those masterclasses, we do learn new skills and enough that it almost changed the way that I was going to think about my research, and learning about some new techniques helped me probably format things a little bit differently and, again, built my own practice and my understanding as I listened to my peers and those who are more experienced researchers.
Mm. Yeah, get something to add, Julie?
Well, I was just actually thinking, Elise, because you mentioned that you came in a little after us, so you're relatively new to the group, and it just reminded me that I think there've been plenty of instances where milestone help or clarification amongst the group has been a part of what's been valuable, you know, because when you're doing a PhD, everyone's journey is a little bit different, but there are lots of rules, aren't there? There's lots of rules and procedures and policies, and having a bit of a safe space to raise those and dig around, because I'm trying to think of an instance, you know, misconceptions about how long a document has to be or when it might be due or who's expected to get this or, you know, who books the room for confirmation. There's been a bunch of stuff like that, hasn't there, that we've just worked out together, and because we're known in a group, we can.
I agree. And I think extending on that, Julie, one thing I've really appreciated from the network is I feel like watching how other people have written up their theses or have, you know, engaged in kind of research translation activities, it's made me feel more confident to do things not in the strict kind of academic way, which of course the rigor is still there. We don't want to lose that by any means, but the creative aspect of being able to, you know, explain your research in a way that isn't just a traditional scientific paper, that you can do a scientific paper with creative elements. What do you think, Lara?
Yeah, I was going to comment that I think one of the valuable things, and it sort of relates to my research, is this idea of being in this group and, you know, is your navigational capacity, which is part of my research. So, you know, you get to know the hot knowledge. So it's not the brochure, it's not the information that's static on the website that you have to go and find. It's that little, you know, sometimes a little detail or a little resource that someone, oh, go and have a look on this link or, you know, and that's quite helpful to, you know, guide you in your own journey, because you might not, you know, that might not exist in us in a, you know, in a brochure like sort of information that's available. So having those connections are really important to navigate your PhD, I guess.
I just thought of the hot topic. Remember when the length of the confirmation document changed?
Yeah.
That was the time. That was a hot topic, and I really appreciated having other people and academics to talk that through with, I think.
No, I definitely agree. What about in terms of having the network as a support mechanism to help us really push ourselves for excellence, ladies? Because I would say that, you know, I sit here amongst a group of really high achieving, high degree research students that we really put ourselves out there. I know, Elise, you know, you've gone to some really, you know, high level conferences that are probably beyond your typical, you know, area of comfort. Julie's already got a publication out. Lara's got a, you know, been working on book chapters. And there are other things that we've done that I think without the network, they might have happened, but I think we've definitely given each other confidence to really push the envelope. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I would definitely agree. And you all inspire me with your continual writing that you do, because that's one of the harder things. If I came from doing a more coursework master's, and so not having that stronger research base can make you a little bit reluctant to put that pen to paper and or keys to the keyboard and start writing. And to see that you've also had those doubts, but now you're on the other side and you're publishing, and I'm reading some of your work. And so that's really inspiring for me. So I think that practice of excellence that you talk about, Hayley, or that spirit of lifting each other up is definitely something that happens within this network.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess it's the accountability that we have with each other, that, you know, you don't want to let anyone down and yeah, you want to lift each other, I think. And I think that the symposium was probably, you know, a good example of that, that we sort of, I think Elise at the beginning was a bit unsure about being part of it, and we're like, doesn't matter that you're at the beginning, you know, just go for it, and we sort of supported each other. So I think that was, yeah, a great example.
I agree, Lara. I think the presenting at this symposium recently was, for me, it was a really good example. Like, I knew that I was going to present on my first research question, but when this opportunity came up to present within this group, I had to really challenge myself to have something to say at that point. And, it, you know, having to think through and give yourself a timeline so that you don't let others in the group down or what have you, and live up to the standards of the others in the group, I think is a really important part of what any group can offer each other. You know, we're learners in the education space, aren't we? So we want to be all about that.
Well, I was just going to say that, Julie, I remember when I started my master's, reading about that higher degree research scholarship is like an apprenticeship, like a research apprenticeship.
Which we undertook together.
Yeah, that's right. That's how long you and I have known each other, like since we were both in that boat together. And I think like the centre definitely embraces HDR students under that apprenticeship model, you know, trying to find opportunities for us, and that high standard that the academics in the centre have really kind of flows through to us as well. So, yeah, no, I agree. I think this symposium was a great opportunity to be able to show the work that we've been doing, but also, yeah, reflect on how the network has supported that. So one other thing I'm really keen to speak to each of you about is, you know, now that we've been on our HDR journeys for a little while now, whether, you know, what we've been learning through our, you know, respective projects and work has had an impact on our professional practice, because each of you have come into higher degree research having had a professional career. So Elise and Julie both coming from professions as teachers and educators in primary and high school. Lara having a diverse kind of range of professional skill sets, but most recently working in higher education for, you know, the last 15 years or so. And I've come, you know, to this work as being a speech pathologist. So we've all done other things and then kind of made this kind of 90 degree shift. And I know for me it has made me think about things differently, and I reflect on things in a different and more, you know, considered kind of way. I wonder for each of you, how has your research made you think or reflect or do things differently?
All right, I'll go first. I think for me, and as you said, I had a very I'm the typical younger person sort of career trajectory. I've worked in very, very different fields, even though I've, you know, my educational background is journalism. But I guess it just made me question more why things I'd done in a particular way. Not that I didn't question before, but I guess, yeah, it's just being more considerate and always looking at, you know, people are approaching from different views. And I think it is important to really have that deep knowledge to be critical. I used to think that, you know, some people were critical thinkers naturally, but it's really hard to be a critical thinker without that deep knowledge, I find. Because otherwise you're just in the surface. I guess my example would be, you know, climate change. I really don't know anything about, like, I know, well, you know, the surface that we hear about the media, that is terrible, but if really, if I'm going to understand what's better to, you know, is it worse to use a paper bag or a plastic bag, I'll be based in a very, like, you know, shallow sort of knowledge. So having that deeper knowledge, understanding what the processes are involved, and you know, and if you move one thing, it's like, you know, particularly in bigger systems like education, there's a lot of actors in it. So I think, yeah, it really helped me think and listen more from other people with their experience, because it's, you know, it's the same thing. I'm working, you know, in education, there's lots of teachers, but I've never been a teacher, so I don't have that day-to-day understanding, you know, of what happens in the classroom. And I guess if there's anything I can bring immediately would be like my parent hat to that, because I see my kids going to school and what their experience is. And also my cultural experience, and you're looking, you know, the way I was raised, the type of school I went, that's very different than what happens in Australia. So I think being, you know, in a research higher degree really helped me to take my time and listen and question a bit more. Yeah.
I agree, Lara. I remember when I first, like, you know, did Master of Philosophy, and I remember thinking, I think I need to read some philosophy. Like, that's kind of why we're here, right? So, and my supervisors had introduced me to Amartya Sen and his theory of human capability. And I remember lying on the carpet when my kids were like 3 and 6 and they were running around me, and I was reading this book, and I just felt like there'd been like this gravitational shift in my life, and thinking, I'm never going to be able to think about things in the same way again. This idea of, like, so Sen talks about the conversion of means to ends, and, you know, makes it so simple and accessible, and that's probably why he won a Nobel Prize. But it just really made me think about things differently. And, you know, when you see people who are quick to judge, I think they haven't read Sen. They don't understand, like, some of these really big ideas about humanity and how they impact people in a way that they don't even know it's happening. Like, so I agree. It just, and I never would have come across that in my professional life, like that work. It just never was in my sphere at all. But having that, and I've carried that always, and I've continued to embed it in the research that I've done because I think it's just so important. So, yeah, it is interesting how the things that you don't even know you need to know about, and you learn about them and then you can't unsee them.
And you just know that you've got to keep learning because there's always
more. Yeah, that's right, because there's a billion more of those things waiting for you to discover.
It is a very humbling experience in that sense, isn't it? You do find yourself less quick to make judgments.
Totally. That's right. And I think I was always pretty good at that, but now I'm like, man, like there is so much more to this. Yeah.
That's right. There's so much I don't know and I need to know. I was thinking
about you, Julie, because you had a really established career, you know, as an English teacher and head of department.
So for me, my professional identity has, or and I'm sure the same goes for you, Elise, but for me, my professional identity is so strong, so much a part of who I am. You know, I'm an English teacher, I'm a leader of English teacher, I'm a defender of English teachers. You know, I lead in the English Teachers Association now, and that's really how I saw myself. To step into this research world as a kind of a full-time operation means having to challenge that part of my, I have to step away from that identity. Otherwise, I can't do this work, you know. And I think on top of that, even I'm stepping into an inclusive education space where actually my profession might be part of the problem. It most certainly is part of the problem, you know. And so to go through the kind of mental and existential exercise of re-seeing myself and what my purpose is as an educator has been enormously challenging. Like you, Hayley, I wouldn't have been able to do it without the philosophy either. I wouldn't have been able to do it without Perse and James and Dewey to make me really rethink what it means to have an educational experience and what does that look like and who's entitled to it, or how can we even define what a fruitful educational experience is. You know, it's all very D&M and somehow you've got to get the publication out, but you don't come out of the other end of it unchanged. And I've been really starting to think lately to myself that I'm starting to have that part, that researcher part of me, become enough of my identity that when I'm thinking about professional learning, I'm wondering, did I always think that way? Or, you know, have I unlearned some stuff already and think it's always been? I don't know. What about you, Elise? You and I are the teachers, aren't we? And we both see that as inextricable from ourselves.
I think you are very right on that, Julie. It is who you are. When you fill out sheets and there's always that, you know, what is your occupation? You know, teacher just comes straight away. Hmm. And to tip that on its head and say, oh, I'm a student now, or I'm a deep thinker, or I'm a reflective learner, there's different hats that we're putting on. And I loved your PowerPoint that you shared, Julie, on our symposium with all the different hats, because it made me think about when we get to a certain age and we're a mother and we're a professional teacher or educator or speech pathologist, and we're now taking on that role of researcher as well. So I think having the professional practice behind us is great, because when I'm reading and I'm reading about other people's research that they've done in the classrooms, I'm always thinking about what that might have looked like, and I've got that imagery with me, which is fantastic. I'm always thinking about what would this mean for the teachers within the classrooms, because coming from a primary background and you are just with students a long time every day and you are so busy that often you don't have time for this reflecting that we're getting the opportunity to do now, to be that the critical learner, Lara, as you were mentioning. And so it is a real privilege to be able to do that now. but I'm always thinking back to what will what I'm doing right now mean for the teachers in the classrooms right now? How can what I'm learning translate for them? How can I improve not only for the students, because that is the ultimate purpose, but do it in a way that I can translate what I'm learning for the teachers as well? So I'm hoping to take what I'm learning now and do a good job of dispersing that information once I'm finished. And I think for me, I'd just like to add, I'm learning so much about social media and the role that that has in dispersing research and making it known to what's out there. And I'm also learning from reading about people's work that they're publishing as well in that dimension. So that's been a little bit of a upskilling for me. And I'm sure it will continue to be as I get further along my journey. But that's not something I had the opportunity to do in my professional practice. So I'm really very appreciative of the different opportunities that this journey is bringing my way.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Elise. Like, we really have an opportunity in our degrees to, in our own, you know, little way, contribute to positive change that goes much, like, way beyond the bounds of, you know, our project or the classroom that we once stood in or et cetera, which I think too, you know, is a beautiful alignment with the Centre for Inclusive Education, like that really, you know, this high quality, impactful research, you know, for students in education and, you know, really having that improvement for experiences for all kids and especially really marginalised students. So, ladies, how do you think your research or something that you've learned through your research helps contribute to this important goal of improving the education experiences of these students?
Oh, look, I think the big learning is really that it's a team game. It's a big job changing the world, and teachers aren't going to do it by themselves. You know, it's going to require academics, and in the case of, you know, the project we're working on, Hayley, it needs speech pathologists, it needs school leaders and academics to help leaders make that difference. It takes policy, you know, you have to get into the policy space.
Yes, multi-level, multi-stakeholder. And at the end of the day, if we listen to the kids, they can help impact at all levels, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, interdisciplinary is a term that people throw around, but I mean, interdisciplinary and interconnectedness is where it's at. It has to, you know, for this big stuff, it has to be like that.
That's interesting. I had a note that said deep understanding and, you know, being able to connect dots. That were my dot points here. I think, yeah, having the, you know, going back to having the deep knowledge in a particular area and then being able to make those connections outside that particular, you know, you're outside your project, how other things connect, how, you know, the systems work, how society works, what are the things we need to challenge. So if you think about inclusive education, I never heard about ableism before. It wasn't something that was in my radar. So it's just learning things that might not be in the mainstream part of society, and it's this idea of, you know, bring that to the, hold on, we need to make changes here because it's not working for everybody. So yeah,
taking that microscopic view of things, Lara, sometimes, because I think there's so many different views on what inclusion looks like and what it is internationally and nationally. And our understanding of that can impact the way that we do our practice, whatever that might be. And so it's thinking about through what that looks like in the little things for me is really important. So not just the attitude of including students with diversity, but also thinking about the way that I remove barriers so that everybody does have access to great learning. And that's where that Amartya Sen's capability approach comes in, doesn't it, Hayley? That it's about removing barriers so that students can have opportunities to develop their capabilities to be the best person that they want to be.
Absolutely. Oh, I think that's like ending on a high there, ladies. I agree. I think that all of these little pockets of gold really do contribute to this plan to change the world for the better. Thanks so much for your time today. I've really appreciated working with you on this symposium, presenting with you when we were in Adelaide, and yeah, having a chance to speak today. So thank you all so much for your contributions. We've also got a blog post that goes alongside this podcast episode, so we'll add that to our show notes. And yeah, we hope that you enjoyed listening to the episode. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Hayley. Thanks, Hayley.